This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Come inside and join me among the maps and PowerPoints in getting briefed on the issues that matter by people who know what they're talking about. And do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to your friends or your enemies or anyone. A thanks to those of you who have recently reviewed us, including Wildcat Dave, Agar1971 and Cobert. And if this briefing room helps you to understand the world, you might like other editions of the podcast. This week, I'm getting briefed on whether the present standoff between Russia and the West marks the start of a new Cold War. So, take your seat in the briefing room. Antonio Guterres is the 9th Secretary General of the United Nations. And here's what he said earlier this month about relations between the West and Russia.
I think we are coming to a situation that is similar to a large extent to what we lived during the Cold War.
From Ukraine to Syria, from Salisbury to cyberspace, there's a battle going on. But a new Cold War, is that really true? If so, what are the new rules of engagement? And who's most likely to win, if anyone? Step inside the briefing room and all will become clear. In the early 1990s, the Soviet Union collapsed and with it, the old Cold War ended. Some even thought a new democratic Russia would be an ally for the West. Why didn't that happen? For many years, the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has followed the rise of Vladimir Putin. His report starts with him revisiting the career of Putin's predecessor, Boris Yeltsin.
Terrible. All you have to do is Google Yeltsin's finest moments and you'll get compilation videos of the man himself dancing drunkenly, falling over, grabbing the baton of a German umpire band, all rather intoxicated. Now, it would be funny if it weren't for the fact that, oh, here he is stumbling on the red carpet. It would be funny if it hadn't been so tragic for so many millions of Russians. The 1990s, it was a national, not only humiliation for Russians, really, having grown up in the Soviet Union, which they'd always seen as one half of the Cold War's great power duopoly, to suddenly find themselves basically relegated to non-entities with a drunk, dysfunctional president where nothing really that their country did mattered. That's on the level of national pride. But then personally, these were times of extreme hardship. You know, people who had been used to all the deprivations of the Soviet Union, but a little something, suddenly had nothing. So when Yeltsin resigned unexpectedly on New Year's Eve, 1999-2000, there was this unknown figure, Vladimir Putin. He was like a blank slate that everyone could pour their hopes and aspirations into. Crucially, not just Russians who wanted a strong leader and somebody to take charge of their country, but also the West. I mean, let's just try and remember what relations were like. Here's a clip from 2001, George Bush talking about his meeting with Vladimir Putin.
I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
I mean, this is George Bush. He had a nickname for Putin. It was Pooty Poot. That's 2001. And over the decade that followed, what I'd like to call Putin 1.0, his sort of first two terms as president and then his little shimmy into being prime minister, Putin was anti-ideological. He had no ideology other than I will be an effective manager, or I will be a more effective manager than the guy that came before, which, of course, wasn't going to be hard. And it worked. He created a middle class in Moscow and other big cities. Not to say that there wasn't immense looting of national wealth going on. There was. But the little people also saw a bit of it. This is 2011. He's preparing to go back into the presidency. And suddenly, there are protests on the streets of Moscow. And this is a real shock to the system for Putin. Think of the context. We've had the Arab Spring. We've had these strongmen rulers falling like dominoes. And suddenly, Putin thinks, I might be next. And it's this that prompts what you might call Putin 2.0. He realizes what he needs to take this further is an ideology. The internal ideology consisted largely of social conservatism, a backing for the Orthodox Church, attacks on LGBT rights. And on the external front, it was about telling the Russian people, we are surrounded by enemies, creating an external enemy that could unite his electorate behind the one man who can hold all things together. Now, one of the people who helped form this new ideology for the Kremlin is Alexander Dugin, extraordinary looking guy. He looks like a sort of cross between Solzhenitsyn and Rasputin. Here he is on the notion of the relativity of truth.
We have our special Russian truth that you need to accept as something that maybe is not your truth.
Even if it's not true.
But if the truth is relative, that doesn't mean that the truth doesn't exist.
Russia is saying, we have our version of events. We no longer accept the ideologies of the West. Here's our truth, and you have to accept that on an equal footing with the West. We're back, guys. That's what they're saying. We are back.
The flags at the checkpoint suggest Crimea is already Russia, and it's starting to feel that way.
That then translates into action abroad. We have Crimea 2014. We have Eastern Ukraine. Then we have Syria. This is a resurgent Russia on the foreign stage under Putin 2.0, who is saying, we want to be treated as equals. So we've gone from the early noughties, where Russia was potentially going to be asked to join NATO. There was talk about that, and Putin didn't rule it out. To today, where people are talking in terms of not just a return to a new Cold War, but potential hot war over reports of chemical attacks in Syria and of the attack in Salisbury.
This is very important. Russia's growing military power is just a guarantee of peace on our planet.
Now, the question is, to what extent is Putin, this man who was seen as an institution, if you like, the one institution that works in a country with weak institutions, the vehicle through which people in Russia, the elite, exercise power. The question here is, to what extent is Putin in control of everything that's happening? If he is in control, then I think to a certain extent, there are grown-ups in the room and we know what we're dealing with. But there are different factions in the Kremlin, and that they're constantly fighting with each other, and Putin keeps the show on the road. Now, if it's the factions who are pushing this latest confrontation with the West, and Putin has in fact lost control to a degree, then I think we need to be a lot more worried.
Gabriel Gatehouse, from whose report it becomes obvious that we have to understand how the Kremlin works and what it or the factions around it believes. Neil Buckley is Financial Times Eastern Europe editor and was its Moscow bureau chief, and he joins me in the studio. Neil Buckley, you've been covering Russia and Eastern Europe for quite a long time now. How do you think the Kremlin has evolved since the last Cold War, in terms of its internal dynamics?
Well, during the last Cold War, there was at least a formal decision-making structure. You had the Central Committee of the Communist Party and you had the Politburo, which was the policy-making body. Now, their discussions, of course, were very opaque, and the standings of people within those bodies was a matter of some mystery. People used to study photographs to see who was standing where to get a sense of who was up and who was down. But we knew broadly who was taking the decisions. And also there were checks and balances within the Communist Party. There were checks and balances on the power of the General Secretary, certainly in the late stages of the Soviet Union. I think what's different today is that decision-making is extremely opaque because it largely takes place outside the formalized structures. And the presidential administration is seen in many ways as being more powerful now than the government. The government really just implements things. And there are fewer formal checks and balances than there were 30 years ago.
So what can we say, as far as we can analyze it, about those different groups and circles and their different attitudes and emphases on foreign policy?
Well, there's a whole cottage industry in Moscow among political scientists and consultants in trying to work out who is in what clan and who leads it and what they believe in. But I think, broadly speaking, virtually all of the clans are supportive, more or less, of Putin's foreign policy. Now, there are more hawkish elements. There's a group of former intelligence and military people who are very hardline. And there are more moderate elements, some of the business figures, some of the other senior political figures. And there is a liberal faction. There's a liberal faction which holds most of the key economic decision-making, policy-making positions, who are perhaps less comfortable with Putin's foreign policy, but tend to bite their tongue because they focus on their job in running the economy. And they've decided that it's better to be inside the tent and try to influence things from there rather than going into opposition as some of their liberal colleagues have done. So I think when it comes to foreign policy, there's relatively wide support for what Putin is doing.
The annexation of the Crimea, which after all was taking a bit of somebody else's country, was pretty extreme. How did the domestic response to that go? And does it mean that Putin feels, do that again?
I think the annexation of Crimea was extremely popular pretty much throughout Russia. So I think it did help consolidate Putin's position very much. I think the danger in terms of further military action like that is really if Putin starts to feel that he is being weakened in other ways. The economy is not performing particularly well. It needs deep reforms. It's not growing very fast. And if there is a sense among society that Putin isn't delivering economically in terms of raising their living standards, he may have to fall back on using foreign policy as a tool to unite Russians again.
Now, you talked earlier about how in the old days, even the General Secretary of the Communist Party was constrained, although I don't imagine that's true going right the way back to Stalin himself. Are there actually any constraints upon Putin? Or does this image of the strong man in the Kremlin who pretty much decides everything, does that hold?
I think there are no real constraints, in the sense that if he and key decision makers around him take a decision, then they can deliver that decision and do so very quickly. At the same time, however, this may sound paradoxical, but Putin is not an all-powerful figure. He's not, in a way, a conventional dictator. He is a balancer, an arbiter among these various groups and clans who are themselves quite powerful. And they defer to him because he is the one who has the electoral mandate. He's gone out and got the support of the people, and that gives him the clout to be the ultimate arbiter and decision maker. But there are factions that also can act with a certain amount, and individuals who can act with a certain amount of autonomy and do things without necessarily getting his say-so.
Neil Buckley. Of course, a Russian perception may contain different nuances. Alexander Baunov is a former Russian diplomat and is now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Moscow Center. Alexander Baunov, how do you think the Russian government analyzes the international situation between itself and the West as it stands now?
A big question is and was for some years already if we are in the situation of a new Cold War, and there were different explanations why we are and why we are not. I explained to my colleagues 1 year or 2 years that we are not in a new Cold War, even after Crimea, but now I'm inclined to think that we are, unfortunately. It's a struggle for what they call equality, and then a kind of retaliation of being rejected by the Western system of, first of all, Western security system, and then, well, the West generally, because the narrative, how the end of the Cold War is analyzed in both countries, I mean, in both the Russia and the West, is quite different. Russian thinks they were not defeated in the Cold War, so it was just the goodwill of Russian population and elite to stop the old system because it was ineffective and to make a new start with capitalist, with market economy, with capitalist Russia. They found themselves in the situation when inside they become third world country and outside they were treated as a very insignificant thing. That was the trauma they started to overcome since, I would say, the mid of 90s, even before Putin. But of course, Putin, it was in the very center of his policy.
So that explains, if you like, the psychology of the Russians regarding their own position. Looking at much more recent events, how do you think they analyze the West? To give you an example, I've seen some Russian foreign policy analysts and advisors talking about how Russia is now on the right side of history and the liberal democracies are on the wrong side of history, that Russia is getting stronger, whereas the European democracies are getting weaker. Do you think that is a perception?
More or less, yes, because Putin, after being rejected by the Western security system, he staged a kind of revolt against the Western elites. That's how it is seen, that the world order is unjust. And then when this rise of populism happened in the Western Europe and United States, they became like a natural elite. We have the coincidence in time of two trends. One trend is this populism inside the West. And then we have this Russian revolt against the Western lead world order. And of course, they are supported each other somehow.
Okay, so does Russia believe that this populist revolt represents a weakness in the West? I mean, there's a kind of confidence about the way in which Russia appears to act that suggests that it actually thinks it's the strong one.
The analysis of how destructive Russia can be or will be against the West, you remember the Soviet time. At the Soviet time, the narrative was there is an anti-Soviet elite and there is a working class that even in the capitalist country are friendly towards the Soviet Union and towards the communist bloc. In the Kremlin, they seriously think there is a liberal elite somehow repressing the natural conservative folks they lead. And that's why the simple people, the average folk, is sympathizing Russia much more than the elite. And that's why you have to address the simple people of the West directly, bypassing the elites.
So Moscow's analysis is that somehow it's on the side of the ordinary people in the West.
Yes. Let's reach the ordinary people in the West because they are much more conservative in the gay rights, in immigration, as their politicians.
I guess that some people in the Kremlin will also have changed their mind and think there's a new Cold War. Are there some of them that are more worried about that than others?
Oh, yes, that's sure. Of course, in Russia, there are people who are happy to participate in the new Cold War. And there are others who understand perfectly that Russia is much weaker economically. It's strong militarily. It's stronger politically. And even in the field of such things as, well, media, propaganda, and so on, in the end, in a serious technological and economic struggle, it will lose. They don't want to cross some no-return lines.
Alexander Baunov, if we are about to embark on a new Cold War, we'll need to understand the term better. How useful is the old Cold War as a guide? Sir Lawrence Friedman is Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Lawrence Friedman, what in strategic terms is a Cold War?
Well, the concept can be traced back to France before the Second World War, when there was a sense that there was a real problem developing with Germany, and it was the period before it, in a sense, it became a proper hot war. So after the Second World War, when the same thing seemed to be happening with the Soviet Union, the term was reinvented as the Cold War, meaning that things weren't hot, there wasn't actual fighting, but that was always a possibility. So I think the key thing about a Cold War is it doesn't involve actual fighting, but it might.
So a Cold War is a hot war in waiting, or a hot war postponed?
Potentially, or just latent.
Now, presumably, a Cold War consists of trying to obtain your objectives or stop the other side attaining their objectives without actually going to the hot war.
Yes, I think the key thing about a situation like this, and to the extent that we're in one now again with Russia, is people look for forms of advantage, but they want to keep it below the threshold of actual warfare. So it's about preparation, deterrence, containment, perhaps occasional non-military coercion. And also, of course, as with the previous Cold War, it may involve proxies fighting, but it shouldn't involve you fighting.
So preparation, deterrence, containment, those are the kind of actions you have to take to it in a Cold War. So how much does the current situation then liken itself to a Cold War?
Well, I think it is a Cold War, but one has to be careful in saying that, that it's quite different to the Cold War that people have in mind normally when they use the term, which is what took place from 1946-47 on until 1989-90. That was a very particular period in international history with very particular features that don't obtain in the same way now.
So what do you think's the same and what do you think's different?
The same is that on the one hand, you have the North Atlantic Alliance, and on the other hand, you have Russia. What's different here is that Russia is much reduced, and a lot of its former allies or partner republics within the old Soviet Union, but certainly the former members of the Warsaw Pact, are now part of NATO. So its sphere of influence has contracted, while that of NATO obviously has expanded. Another similarity is that nuclear weapons are involved. But during the first Cold War, if we put it like that, NATO felt that it was at a disadvantage militarily in conventional terms to the Warsaw Pact. So it stressed the importance of nuclear deterrence, whereas now it's sort of the other way around. The Russians feel at a disadvantage militarily, especially if it was a long war, and therefore they stress the importance of nuclear deterrence. Another big difference is that in the first Cold War, the United States was the top economy, but Russia was the second biggest international economy. It's now way down the league table, competing with Spain or Australia. And I suppose the final thing to keep in mind is that a lot of its security concerns are within the area of the former Soviet Union: Georgia, Ukraine, Estonia, Lithuania. All of these countries used to be run from Moscow, whereas now they're seen as security threats. So all of these things mean that it's a much less balanced, symmetrical situation than it was in the 40s to the 80s.
Lawrence Friedman. Clearly, the 20th century version of Cold War took place in a world very different to that of today. Think Novichok, cyber war and Putin bots. So what should the rules of engagement be for a 21st century Cold War? How should the West respond now to what it sees as intolerable Russian behaviour? Professor Angela Stent from Georgetown University is a former US State Department official who has written several books about relations between Russia and the West. She joined me on the line from Washington. Angela Stent, there's now this talk of the possibility of a new Cold War. We might be in a new Cold War. How do you see that situation?
Well, it certainly feels like a Cold War, with the mutual invective of the United States against Russia, of many European countries against Russia. You've had saber rattling from Mr. Putin, particularly in a pre-election speech he gave last month, where he displayed in video graphics these new weapons that were going to sweep down over the South Pole and then hit and launch missiles on Mar-a-Lago in South Florida, which is President Trump's home. And you've had some pretty bellicose rhetoric also, on the one hand, from the White House talking about we're going to build up our nuclear weapons as well. So it has that feel. And obviously, both sides are very wary of each other.
Do we have a technological advantage in conventional weaponry?
I think so far, I would say the West does. But as far as we know, but the Russians are obviously developing conventional weapons. They seem to be focusing, at least recently under Putin, much more on the nuclear side of it and trying to enhance their nuclear capabilities. And if one is to believe what Mr. Putin said in March about these new supersonic weapons, undersea cruise missiles, if one is to believe that, then of course they would have a technological advantage there. But nobody's quite sure how far along they are in developing these weapons.
How do you think, under these new circumstances, the West can properly respond to actions by Russia that it regards as being on the verge of intolerable?
The formulas from the Cold War were two, really. One of them was containment, and the other one was deterrence. It's much harder to contain Russia in the cyber age because, as we've seen in terms of what happened in the US elections and what's happened in Britain and other European countries, this is a whole new area where we have no accepted rules of the road. And of course, the West, we have cyber capabilities too, but the Russians seem to have been one step ahead of us. The combination of high-tech cyber and then the manipulation of social media, which isn't that high-tech, but it's fairly well advanced. And deterrence, I think there, conventional deterrence we're trying, for instance, in Europe, obviously, NATO has beefed up their troop strength, particularly in the Baltic area. And the US now, if you read the latest nuclear posture review, is going to concentrate on building up its nuclear weapons. But we don't seem to have been so far very successful in deterring Russia in its immediate neighborhood. I'm talking about Georgia, Ukraine, and other places. And that's because the Europeans and the US have understood or made the decision that they're not going to respond militarily to what Russia has done in its own backyard, even though that has certainly threatened peace and stability in Europe.
When we talk about containment as two separate sides of the same strategy, if we were to apply it to a current situation, let's say to Syria or to Ukraine, what would doctrines of containment or deterrence tell you about those situations?
So I think Ukraine would tell you that conventional containment and deterrence didn't work, again, because this is Russia's immediate neighborhood. And the Russians obviously calculated that there wouldn't be a Western military response, and that's why they went ahead and did it. Now, in Syria, what we seem to have had, at least this week, is the Syrians went ahead, one assumes, I mean, obviously it still has to be proven, but they used chemical weapons on their own population. The Russians didn't stop them. Then the United States threatened a response. Then there was one Russian ambassador, I think maybe speaking out of turn, in the Middle East who said, if the U.S. does anything militarily, we're going to respond. And that didn't happen. So there was a limited use of force by the U.S. and Britain and France. Clearly, they were told the Russians beforehand there was some deconfliction talks so that the Russians had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen. That is to say, deconfliction talks are going on all the time between the U.S. and Russia in terms of air power in Syria so that we don't essentially, you know, have a mid-air collision or shoot each other's planes down. And so the same channels were used, apparently, to inform the Russians that this was going to happen and that the sites were going to be these chemical weapons sites. So that happened. And then we saw, despite some of the bluster one heard from the Russians, there was no Russian response. So you could say that's an example of at least deterring the Russians from doing anything else. The Russians did not want to escalate this. But we're still, I think, on very thin ice there.
Angela Stent. So how to sum up? Well, yes, there is something of a new Cold War. No, the West is not at a material disadvantage in contesting it. But yes, it will be fought over new political and technological terrain. My thanks to Alexander Baunov, Angela Stent, Sir Lawrence Friedman, Neil Buckley and Gabriel Gatehouse. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling and Beth Sagar-Fenton. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider, and we really do love hearing from you.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.